Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Chicago, Illinois for a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer. On March 19, 2019, the FDA approved the combination of atezolizumab with carboplatin and etoposide for the frontline treatment of patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. The regulatory decision was based on data from the Phase 3 EMPOWER 133 trial, which demonstrated a significant improvement in overall survival with the addition of atezolizumab to standard chemotherapy. After a median follow-up of 13.9 months, the median overall survival was 12.3 months in the atezolizumab arm versus 10.3 months in the carboplatin, etoposide, and placebo arm, reflecting a 24% reduction in the risk of death. The regimen has since become the frontline standard of care for patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. Recently, on March 30, 2020, the FDA approved durvalumab for use in combination with etoposide and either carboplatin or cisplatin as first-line treatment of patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. The approval is based on data from the Phase 3 Caspian trial, which showed a 27% reduction in the risk of death with the addition of durvalumab to standard chemotherapy. The median overall survival was 13 months in the durvalumab arm versus 10.3 months in the chemotherapy alone arm. With this approval, an additional standard of care has been added to the frontline setting. However, limited options remain for patients whose disease progresses, and there is controversy regarding whether the use of immunotherapy in the frontline setting precludes its use in the second-line setting. In advanced non-small cell lung cancer, chemoimmunotherapy and immunotherapy alone have become standards of care in the frontline setting. While targeted therapy for patients with EGFR, ALK, and ROS1 mutations is the recommended first-line standard in the advanced setting, it's not clear whether patients with MET exon 14 mutations can defer targeted therapy in the frontline setting in lieu of chemoimmunotherapy or immunotherapy alone. Therefore, this week, we sat down with Jody D. Patel, MD, Professor of Medicine at Northwestern University, Associate Vice Chair for Clinical Research in the Department of Medicine at Feinberg School of Medicine, Medical Director of Thoracic Oncology at the University of Chicago Medicine, and Assistant Director for Clinical Research in the Lurie Cancer Center, along with Lawrence E. Feldman, MD, a Professor of Clinical Medicine at the University of Illinois Cancer Center, to discuss second-line therapy in extensive-stage small cell lung cancer. In our discussion, Drs. Patel and Feldman discussed the need for consolidative radiation, as well as the optimal sequence of therapy for a patient with non-small cell lung cancer who harbors a MET exon 14 mutation. First, we hear from Dr. Feldman, who shares a case of a 55-year-old man who presented with a right upper lobe mass and a right pleural effusion. The man underwent a CT-guided biopsy, which indicated small cell lung cancer. Listen on to hear the complete case presentation that led up to his diagnosis of extensive stage small cell lung cancer and a potential course of treatment.
First case is a 55-year-old gentleman who presented with a small cell, a large right upper lobe mass, T4N2M1A with a right pleural effusion. He underwent a CT-guided biopsy as well as removal of the pleural fluid, and also a bronchoscopy and EBUS, and the biopsy came back as small cell lung cancer. He was otherwise in good health. He didn't have any weight loss, and he had a brain MRI, which was negative for brain metastatic disease. So therefore, he had extensive stage disease because he was M1A with the right pleural effusion. And we started him on carboplatin, etoposide, and atezolizumab based on the recent results of the IMPRIME 133 trial He also had a bone scan, which did not reveal any osseous mets. He received 4 cycles of carboplatin atezolizumab without any problem. And then the CT scan after those 4 cycles showed improvement in his disease, a good partial response. And then he received, started on maintenance atezolizumab for about 8 months. And he was actually doing well. He continued to remain asymptomatic. And then he developed bilateral adrenal metastases, an increasing size of his right paratracheal lymphadenopathy. And at that point, we had to talk to him about switching to second line therapy. You know, the options at that point would be chemotherapy with topotecan or another second line agent or something investigational. Since he was asymptomatic and doing well, we put him on a clinical trial through the Big Ten Cancer Research Consortium, BTCRC 17127, with a combination of ipi-nivo plus a drug called plinabulin, which is a immune modulator. And he's received 1 cycle so far of this. It's a phase 1b/2 trial. So he's getting nivo ipi, which I was interested in using anyway, but then it's adding plinabulin. However, the NCCN guidelines at this point in time do not recommend dual immunotherapy for second-line small cell if they've already failed a checkpoint inhibitor. So I couldn't do it off-study, but since we had the study available, I decided to put him on the study with a combination IO therapy plus plinabulin. And so far, he tolerated the first cycle very well.
So this was a good performance status patient. A lot of ours aren't when they're diagnosed with small cell. So you were able to get to treat him as an outpatient, something that we can't always do with small cell. Have you been in a situation where you've wanted to give a checkpoint inhibitor to a patient who's diagnosed sort of in the hospital? Sort of what's your algorithm there? What do you do?
So I actually, at the same time, have a patient who is a bit of a similar story, who, except she had a limited stage disease. She's also in her late 50s, early 60s. She was treated with chemo radiation. She did not get a checkpoint inhibitor because of that. She had limited stage disease. She then, after about 6 months, she recurred with very aggressive disease involving her liver and her bones and even her bone marrow. And her bone marrow was actually pretty widely spread in her bone marrow, such that her blood counts started dropping and her platelets are low and her other cell lines are fairly low. So in a case like that, even though it's second line and she hasn't had immunotherapy, I decided to give her topotecan to just try to get as quick of a response as possible, given the fact that she's had such aggressive disease. So she received 1 cycle so far of topotecan and tolerated it well. Now, since she didn't have prior IO therapy, I probably would have started her on nivo-ipi as a second line therapy. But since she had such aggressive disease, I went with the traditional second line chemotherapy. And then if I do get a good response with the topotecan, my plan is then to switch her over to checkpoint inhibitor therapy, probably with the combination of ipi-nivo.
So the atezo up front in the first patient was added for based on a trial that we all agree is positive. Thoughts about the different agents between durvalumab or atezolizumab, similarities between the trials, or any differences between the trials that you think are relevant?
I think the two trials were similar in terms of the overall survival benefit seen. in with both agents. And so I didn't feel like there's a great deal of difference in the two trials, and we'll pretty much have a choice of either one. I can't see any particular benefit of one over the other in this particular space.
What was remarkable to me about the trials was that they had the exact same number for the control arms for overall survival, and seeing that across two trials, I think really changes what our historical control is. Like I thought it was super helpful. The hazard mm-hmm. ratio, as you said, is pretty similar, as was the overall survival.
The DERVA trial gave the investigator, they could use either carbo or cis, whereas the Empower 133 trial mandated carbo etoposide. So, but as you said, the survival data look similar in both trials, so probably doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
I guess we wait for the second part of the DERVA trial of the Caspian study, which also includes DERVA plus TREMI, so the CTLA-4 up front, which makes our second line questions even harder. We wait for it to be reported, but if that is positive or more positive, I think that ends up sort of changing our paradigm. What about PCI for someone with extensive stage disease? Your patient didn't have any brain metastasis. What are you doing in extensive stage and in limited stage?
Myself, I'm leaning toward holding off on PCI for the most part, given recent more recent results from a Japanese trial, which included patients who, in the post-MRI era, I think that if we can follow our patients closely with MRIs every 3 months, I think that we can maybe spare them the toxicity from radiation, the cognitive toxicity, and impacting on quality of life with PCI. But having said that, I think some of it is probably going to be patient-specific. Kind of have to, at this point, since we don't have very good controlled randomized trials with PCI and the post in the MRI era, I think that we have to make decisions on an individual basis. I will often spare patients toxicity with PCI. The toxicity in terms of cognition and quality of life seem to be equivalent to what is being seen with whole brain radiation therapy, for example, in non-small cell lung cancer. And so if they have a negative MRI up front, then often we at our institution, and a radiation therapist, has the same philosophy that we kind of follow them very closely with like every 3 month MRI scans. What's your approach in terms of PCI?
I would agree that, again, because of the cognitive dysfunction, often also a decrease in performance status for patients that they may not be able to fully recover from, and what is often an elderly group of patients, I tend to hold back and do surveillance for patients with extensive stage disease. With limited stage disease, I think the question is a little bit more difficult. I guess everyone should know that there is now a randomized study that is ongoing that will look at both stages of disease. We hope that maybe, you know, as these trials mature, we'll see the same sort of decreases in CNS effects that we saw in patients with stage 3 disease, that we see sort of less brain relapse, so we may be able to spare PCI. You know, a little has also changed in my mind. The NRG trial showing hippocampal sparing during whole brain for patients with brain metastasis shows that now with delivery of radiation, we can decrease the risk of cognitive toxicity and neurologic symptoms. As radiation continues to refine, there may also, you know, we may be better at delivering potentially curative therapy to these patients. For patients with extensive stage disease who have a good response, do you ever consider chest radiation, and how does that fit into your paradigm in a patient with immunotherapy?
So, yeah, if they have extensive stage disease and they have a good response, but they still, you know, especially if they started out with a large mass, like this patient that I described, he had a T4 mass based on a very large size, and, you know, he could potentially be someone that I would try to consolidate with thoracic radiation. I'm not sure in retrospect if it would have helped, because he recurred, his recurrence was in the distance, with distant disease, so I don't know if that would have or wouldn't have, you know, made a difference. But we do consolidation from time to time in the thoracic area, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of good randomized controlled studies to show survival advantage. I'm not aware of it. For example, I have had a patient who had a similar presentation with a left lung mass and a pleural effusion, and we gave him 4 cycles of chemotherapy. This was before the era of immunotherapy. He did have some residual disease on CT after therapy, so he got consolidation to SBRT to the lung mass, and he's like 5 years out, and he's doing extremely well, especially if somebody has a minimal disease and they might have some residual like abnormalities on scan. It wouldn't be unreasonable to consolidate it with like some local definitive therapy.
I think with the increasing interest in immunotherapy and radiation, it may be that sort of debulking with radiation and stimulating an immune response could potentiate effects of immunotherapy in frontline. Certainly, we know that PD-L and TMB have not been predictive in response for patients with muscle, but samples are so limited, there's so much crush and necrosis that I think it's a little bit hard to tell if there are patients that we can better select on biologic parameters. You didn't talk about topotecan. Well, I guess that patient that we were sort of forced into treating with topotecan in the hospital because of immediate response. Is that essentially where topotecan stands for you now as a second line agent? It's for a patient who is immune therapy intolerant or who needs a response quickly?
Yeah, those are two scenarios where I would use topotecan. Even in this gentleman who progressed on maintenance of tezo, my first choice was to give dual checkpoint inhibitor, but I was quickly informed by my pharmacy that and his insurance that they wouldn't cover it, and then in the NCCN guidelines it does not recommend dual checkpoint inhibitor in that setting. So I was forced from that standpoint to either put him on a clinical trial or use topotecan in that setting. And then I would just try to look for second line trials. There's quite a bit going on, thankfully, finally, in small cell lung cancer, which, you know, there's been many years where there hasn't been a whole lot of interest, especially in the second line for small cell lung cancer. So, for example, there's trials looking at targeting DLL3 with either CAR T cells or with so-called BiTE molecule, which is bispecific T cell engager molecule. you know, those are just a couple of examples of some interesting clinical trials involving immunotherapy in this setting. And then at the Big Ten trial that we put this patient on, it's very interesting because since it's a phase one trial, they open up like three spots for the patients. Once those spots are filled, they put a hold on the study and look over toxicity. But there's literally like a long waiting list of patients to get spots. I was lucky enough to get a spot for this trial for this patient because of the strong interest in this area. And so, but this trial will be opening up soon in a phase two setting. So there'll be more spots available for putting people on that particular trial. I would just encourage oncologists to see what clinical trials are available for a small cell in the second line setting in their area, just because historically, I think many people are not impressed by the results with topotecan in the second line setting. At least up till now, I haven't really had very good results with patients giving topotecan, but I know that some people have also had better success rates than I've had anecdotally. What's been your experience with second line treatment in small cell?
I think there are some patients who've had some disease-free period who have good responses to topotecan. I tend to use a little bit more of the taxanes in that setting than topotecan because of the myelosuppression. I have had some success recently. I don't know if we'll end up seeing the same thing that we have observed in non-small cell lung cancer, where it seems the chemotherapy rates are a little bit higher after immunotherapy. Again, you know, our sort of we don't have great control arms post atezo or durva in the frontline setting. So, you know, I think that's sort of a moving target. Generally, for patients after checkpoint inhibitor in the frontline setting, I go to chemotherapy first and then may circle back to an immunotherapy. That being said, I've had some patients that we've treated over the years who have had dual checkpoint blockade and are disease-free, a couple of years later. So certainly it's about patient selection because there are some patients that benefit pretty significantly.
Yeah, that's interesting that things might change in the post-immunotherapy era and seeing how chemotherapy does post-immunotherapy. So it's exciting that a lot is going on in small cell that, you know, for many years, as you know, wasn't a lot of progress previously.
There are some more interesting trials. There are consortia in which to develop animal models, which I think will be important as we evaluate drugs. So the field is changing pretty rapidly.
Next, Dr. Patel shares a case of a 78-year-old man who presented to his orthopedist with shoulder pain. A full workup revealed a clavicular mass, right upper lobe mass, metastases in his tibia, mediastinal adenopathy, and adrenal metastases. Listen on to hear the full case presentation, the patient's ultimate diagnosis, and the recommended course of treatment.
So the second case I want to talk about is a gentleman I've been seeing for some time. He is a 78-year-old man who was quite healthy and in pretty good shape, sort of an avid golfer. He had smoked for about 25 years and quit almost 30 years ago. He presented to his orthopedist with some shoulder pain, and evaluation showed that he had a clavicular mass as well as a right upper lobe mass, some bone metastasis in his tibia, and some mediastinal adenopathy and an adrenal met. He ended up having a biopsy, and it showed an adenosquamous carcinoma. His PD-L score at that juncture was 40%. This biopsy was done from his bone, from his clavicular lesion, actually, but it was well processed. It wasn't decalcified. So he returned from down south to Chicago to talk about treatment recommendations. At that juncture, you know, he was a little bit limited from the clavicular met and some pain, but otherwise had just hypertension as his only medical problem. We went ahead and got an MRI after I saw him, and he was also found to have a 1.5 centimeter right temporal lesion without much edema. So at that juncture, you know, he had a pretty high PDL, but not over 50%. Given that he had an adenosquamous cancer, I thought it would be important to do NGS. And he was sort of anxious about waiting for initiation of therapy while we found that answer out. But we wanted to do some radiation to the clavicle to provide relief. And so we initiated that radiation and then started the process of getting his NGS done. Well, lo and behold, he had a MET exon 14 mutation. And at that juncture, I think sort of my questions were, should I treat this gentleman with chemotherapy and immunotherapy? Should I give him immunotherapy alone, or should I look to start him on a TKI? Given that he already had a brain met, I went ahead and we did SRS to that lesion, but I was less excited about starting him on crizotinib, knowing that he'd already had disease in the brain. At that juncture, we actually had a clinical trial with the more selective MET TKI inhibitor, tepotinib, and we enrolled him on that clinical trial. He ended up with a quite nice response in all of his systemic disease and did not develop progressive brain disease for quite some time. So he was on for almost a year. The TKI was very well tolerated. He had some issues with lower extremity edema, which was a little bit bothersome for him, but that was grade one. And other than that, he did quite well. Larry, thoughts about what you would have done? Would you have put him on the TKI, which would have been available in the first or second line setting, or given his high PDL and his smoking history, would you have treated him with immunotherapy and chemotherapy?
That's a very interesting case, and it sounds like he did extremely well on the TKI therapy that you put him on. I would say that the first line mutations that we target, you know, traditionally would be EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. I don't know that the MET exon 14 skipping mutation is ready for first line treatment in terms of like national guidelines. And so I probably, not having a trial available for this particular mutation, I probably would have gone with something like chemoimmunotherapy, expecting that he would do pretty well with combination therapy because of his fairly high PD-L1 expression, although not greater than 50%, it's pretty close. So that's probably what I would do, and then maybe reserve TKI therapy for like second line therapy. You know, not having a trial open, I would probably go with one of the commercially available TKIs, such as crizotinib.
We've had a number of patients who we've been able to pick up, Matt. I have to say, you know, they're distinct clinical features. So this I was a little bit older, which we see with MET exon 14, more so than perhaps EGFR and ALK. We do see mixed histology, so squamous, non-small cell lung cancers. Again, it's a population that may have had a smoking history or older, has mixed histology, and so we're testing much more broadly. There's also MET amplification, which is has been studied with crizotinib as well, and some of those patients with very high MET gene amplification demonstrate some responses. I think the MET exon 14, there are a number of drugs right now. So I had tepotinib, capmatinib's been approved or has been presented. Certainly crizotinib has activity, but sort of that Achilles heel of no CNS penetration, I think, all factor in. So this gentleman did quite well on the TKI, and because I had it available, you know, was happy to put him on it. There's also some data that has been presented, some retrospective data, and small numbers, but this suggests a decreased likelihood of response to IO with MET exon 14 mutations. And so, you know, I guess there's a little, or I had a little bit of hesitancy. Moreover, the patient was really happy to be on an oral drug. So he did well for about a year, and then he actually had progression in his adrenal MET. And most of the other disease had responded really significantly. So he had sort of one area of disease. At that juncture, we looked at sort of our trial portfolio, and we had a MET-targeted antibody-drug conjugate available. And he was eligible to go on it with the prior TKI. So we repeated a biopsy to understand if we could figure out why he'd developed resistance to tepotinib. And then interestingly, that biopsy of his adrenal showed almost full squamous differentiation. The adeno part had gone, the PDL score now was like 5%. And then we submitted that tissue for the ADC. He tolerated the ADC and had a secondary response to the therapy and had not as deep a response with the TKI, but he had a little bit of back pain that improved after trial initiation, and he did quite well and was able to stay on drug for about 6 months. At that juncture, he had progression in the chest, and so we said, okay, it's probably time to move forward. And so he's been initiated on chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Given that he was squamous and he had a little bit of neuropathy from the ADC, I ended up putting him on carboplatin Taxol and or paclitaxel and pembrolizumab, and he's due for response assessment. He's been having a harder time with it, with the cytotoxic chemotherapy, than with the targeted therapy, certainly. But I'm anxious to see what these next scans look like. Throughout all of this, his brain has been well controlled. I was a little bit nervous about the ADC, whether he'd have CNS penetration, but no evidence of CNS metastasis. After coming off of the TKI and the ADC, his lower extremity edema is also resolved.
That's interesting. I also have an squamous patient right now, and she got chemoimmuno up front, and we, for some reason, we're not able to get NGS up front, and then she recurred after chemoimmunotherapy. We re-biopsied her. She had some pleural recurrence, and the re-biopsy showed the same thing as the original biopsy, being both adeno and squamous. So I was just wondering, like, if you just saw primarily squamous in the recurrence, what did you repeat the NGS, and did it still confirm that showing the exon 14 mutation?
We did, and it still had the exon 14 and nothing else new. So we didn't really have a good reason for resistance either. So I guess a couple of things. The PDL also changed. We know that there is a fair bit of heterogeneity of expression and sampling. So that I wasn't surprised by, but as you said, the histology change was pretty interesting to us.
Yeah, and then I know, like, traditionally we think of, targetable mutations as being mostly in adenocarcinoma as opposed to squamous, but I know I also had a recent case of a patient with squamous who we found a ROS1, translocation of ROS1. So it just kind of goes to show you that, like you said, it's even if there's not just traditional adenocarcinoma, but squamous as well, we should think about sending for NGS testing. Do you test NGS in all your non-small cells, or do you pick and choose? With adenosquamous, you don't know, but you found something that was targetable and it was quite beneficial for the patient.
Right. And, I was saying it's almost 20% of sarcomatoids I've been testing in that. If anyone certainly has a distant smoking history or no never smoking history, or if there's an admixture, I always test. It's certainly become much easier for a patient with squamous cell now with the lung map, right, that we're able to do NGS on our patients if they're eligible for screening. Again, that's second line, but that I think is something people should consider if they've got pushback. I tend to do it a little bit more broadly than I had a couple of years ago, just with our MET experience, frankly.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.